Listening Library presents The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak. Read for you by Alan Cordier. The Floating Book, Part 2. At the beginning of December, victory finally came to Rudi Steiner, though not in a typical fashion. It was a cold day, but very still. It had come close to snowing. After school, Rudi and Liesl stopped in at Alex Steiner's shop, and as they walked home, they saw Rudi's old friend Franz Deutscher coming around the corner. Liesl, as was her habit these days, was carrying the whistler. She liked to feel it in her hand, either the smooth spine or the rough edges of paper. It was she who saw him first.
"Look!"
she pointed. Deutscher was loping toward them with another Hitler Youth leader. Rudi shrank into himself. He felt at his mending eye.
"Not this time."
He searched the streets.
"If we go past the church, we can follow the river and cut back that way."
With no further words, Liesl followed him, and they successfully avoided Rudy's tormentor, straight into the path of another. At first, they thought nothing of it. The group crossing the bridge and smoking cigarettes could have been anybody, and it was too late to turn around when the two parties recognized each other.
"Oh no, they've seen us!"
Victor Chemmel smiled. He spoke very amiably. This could only mean that he was at his most dangerous.
"Well, well, if it isn't Rudi Steiner and his little whore."
Very smoothly, he met them and snatched the whistler from Liesl's grip.
"What are we reading?"
"This is between us,"
Rudi tried to reason with him.
"It has nothing to do with her. Come on, give it back."
"The whistler?" he addressed Liesl now. "Any good?"
She cleared her throat.
"Not bad."
Unfortunately, she gave herself away. In the eyes, they were agitated. She knew the exact moment when Victor Chemmel established that the book was a prize possession.
"I'll tell you what," he said. "For 50 marks, you can have it back."
50 marks?
That was Andy Schmeichel. "Come on, Victor, you could buy 1,000 books for that." "Did I ask you to speak?" Andy kept quiet. His mouth seemed to swing shut. Liesl tried a poker face.
"You can keep it, then. I've already read it."
"What happens at the end?"
Damn it. She hadn't gotten that far yet. She hesitated, and Victor Chemmel deciphered it instantly. Rudi rushed at him now.
"Come on, Victor. Don't do this to her. It's me you're after. I'll do anything you want."
The older boy only swatted him away, the book held aloft, and he corrected him.
"No," he said, "I'll do anything I want."
And he proceeded to the river. Everyone followed at catch-up speed, half walk, half run. Some protested, some urged him on. It was so quick and relaxed. There was a question and a mocking, friendly voice.
"Tell me," Victor said, "who was the last Olympic discus champion in Berlin?"
He turned to face them. He warmed up his arm.
"Who was it? God damn it, it's on the tip of my tongue. It was that American, wasn't it? Carpenter or something. Please!"
Rudi. The water toppled. Victor Chemmel did the spin. The book was released gloriously from his hand. It opened and flapped, the pages rattling as it covered ground in the air. More abruptly than expected, it stopped and appeared to be sucked toward the water. It clapped when it hit the surface and began to float downstream. Victor shook his head.
"Not enough height, a poor throw."
He smiled again.
"But still good enough to win, huh?"
Liesl and Rudi didn't stick around to hear the laughter. Rudi, in particular, had taken off down the riverbank, attempting to locate the book.
"Can you see it?"
Liesl called out. Rudi ran. He continued down the water's edge, showing her the book's location.
"Over there!"
He stopped and pointed and ran farther down to overtake it. Soon he peeled off his coat and jumped in, wading to the middle of the river. Liesel, slowing to a walk, could see the ache of each step. The painful cold. When she was close enough, she saw it move past him, but he soon caught up. His hand reached in and collared what was now a soggy block of cardboard and paper. "The Whistler!" the boy called out. It was the only book floating down the Amper River that day, but he still felt the need to announce it. Another note of interest is that Rudy did not attempt to leave the devastatingly cold water as soon as he held the book in his hand. For a good minute or so, he stayed. He never did explain it to Liesel, but I think she knew very well that the reasons were twofold. The Frozen Motives of Rudy Steiner. 1. After months of failure, this moment was his only chance to revel in some victory. 2. Such a position of selflessness was a good place to ask Liesel for the usual favor. How could she possibly turn him down?
"How about a kiss, Sarmensch?"
He stood waist-deep in the water for a few moments longer before climbing out and handing her the book. His pants clung to him, and he did not stop walking. In truth, I think he was afraid. Rudy Steiner was scared of the book thief's kiss. He must have longed for it so much. He must have loved her so incredibly hard. So hard that he would never ask for her lips again, and would go to his grave without them. Part 6. The Dream Carrier. Featuring Death's Diary, The Snowman, 13 Presents, The Next Book, The Nightmare of a Jewish Corpse, A Newspaper Sky, A Visitor, A Schmunzler, and A Final Kiss on Poisoned Cheeks. Death's Diary, 1942. It was a year for the ages, like 79, like 1346, to name just a few. Forget the scythe, goddammit, I needed a broom or a mop. And I needed a vacation. A small piece of truth. I do not carry a sickle or scythe. I only wear a hooded black robe when it's cold. And I don't have those skull-like facial features you seem to enjoy pinning on me from a distance. You want to know what I truly look like? I'll help you out. Find yourself a mirror while I continue. I actually feel quite self-indulgent at the moment, telling you all about me, 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 my travels, what I saw in 42. On the other hand, you're a human. You should understand self-obsession. The point is, there's a reason for me explaining what I saw in that time. Much of it would have repercussions for Liesel Memminger. It brought the war closer to Himmel Street, and it dragged me along for the ride. There were certainly some rounds to be made that year, from Poland to Russia to Africa and back again. You might argue that I make the rounds no matter what year it is, but sometimes the human race likes to crank things up a little. They increase the production of bodies and their escaping souls. A few bombs usually do the trick. Or some gas chambers. Or the chit-chat of faraway guns. If none of that finishes proceedings, it at least strips people of their living arrangements. And I witness the homeless everywhere. They often come after me as I wander through the streets of molested cities. They beg me to take them with me. Not realizing I'm too busy as it is. Your time will come, I convince them, and I try not to look back. At times, I wish I could say something like, "Don't you see I've already got enough on my plate?" But I never do. I complain internally as I go about my work, and some years, the souls and bodies don't add up. They multiply. An abridged roll call for 1942. 1. The Desperate Jews. Their spirits in my lap as we sat on the roof next to the steaming chimneys. 2. The Russian soldiers, taking only small amounts of ammunition, relying on the fallen for the rest of it. 3.
the soaked bodies of a French coast, beached on the shingle and sand. I could go on, but I've decided for now that three examples will suffice. Three examples, if nothing else, will give you the ashen taste in your mouth that defined my existence during that year. So many humans, so many colors. They keep triggering inside me. They harass my memory. I see them tall in their heaps, all mounted on top of each other. There is air like plastic, a horizon like setting glue. There are skies manufactured by people, punctured and leaking, and there are soft, coal-colored clouds, beating like black hearts. And then there is death, making his way through all of it. On the surface, unflappable, unwavering. Below, unnerved, untied, and undone. In all honesty, and I know I'm complaining excessively now, I was still getting over Stalin in Russia. The so-called Second Revolution, the murder of his own people. Then came Hitler. They say that war is death's best friend. But I must offer you a different point of view on that one. To me, war is like the new boss who expects the impossible. He stands over your shoulder repeating one thing incessantly. Get it done. Get it done. So you work harder. You get the job done. The boss, however, does not thank you. He asks for more. Often, I try to remember the strewn pieces of beauty I saw in that time as well. I plow through my library of stories. In fact, I reach for one now. I believe you know half of it already, and if you come with me, I'll show you the rest. I'll show you the second half of a book thief. Unknowingly, she awaits a great many things that I alluded to just a minute ago, but she also waits for you. She's carrying some snow down to a basement, of all places. Handfuls of frosty water can make almost anyone smile, but it cannot make them forget. Here she comes. The Snowman. For Liesl Memminger, the early stages of 1942 could be summed up like this. She became 13 years of age. Her chest was still flat. She had not yet bled. The young man from her basement was now in her bed. Q&A. How did Max Vandenberg end up in Liesl's bed? He fell. Opinions varied, but Rosa Huberman claimed that the seeds were sown at Christmas the previous year. December the 24th had been hungry and cold, but there was a major bonus, no lengthy visitations. Hans Jr. was simultaneously shooting at Russians and maintaining his strike on family interaction. Trudy could only stop by on the weekend before Christmas for a few hours. She was going away with her family of employment, a holiday for a very different class of Germany. On Christmas Eve, Liesl brought down a double handful of snow as a present for Max.
"Close your eyes," she'd said. "Hold out your hands."
As soon as the snow was transferred, Max shivered and laughed, but he still didn't open his eyes. He only gave the snow a quick taste, allowing it to sink into his lips. "Is this today's weather report?" Liesl stood next to him. Gently, she touched his arm. He raised it again to his mouth. "Thanks, Liesl." It was the beginning of the greatest Christmas ever. Little food, no presents, but there was a snowman in their basement. After delivering the first handfuls of snow, Liesl checked that no one else was outside, then proceeded to take as many buckets and pots out as she could. She filled them with the mounds of snow and ice that blanketed the small strip of world that was Himmel Street. Once they were full, she brought them in and carried them down to the basement. All things being fair, she first threw a snowball at Max and collected a reply in the stomach. Max even threw one at Hans Huberman as he made his way down the basement steps.
"Arschloch!" Papa yelped.
Liesel, give me some of that snow. A whole bucket. For a few minutes, they all forgot. There was no more yelling or calling out, but they could not contain the small snatches of laughter. They were only humans playing in the snow in a house. Papa looked at the snow-filled pots.
What do we do with the rest of it?
A snowman, Liesel replied. We have to make a snowman.
Papa called out to Rosa. The usual distant voice was hurled back.
What is it now, Zaukerl? Come down here, will you?
When his wife appeared, Hans Huberman risked his life by throwing a most excellent snowball at her. Just missing, it disintegrated when it hit the wall, and Mama had an excuse to swear for a long time without taking a breath. Once she recovered, she came down and helped them. She even brought the buttons for the eyes and nose, and some string for a snowman smile. Even a scarf and hat were provided for what was really only a 2-foot man of snow.
A midget, Max had said.
What do we do when it melts?
Liesel asked. Rosa had the answer.
You mop it up, Zaumensch, in a hurry.
Papa disagreed.
It won't melt.
He rubbed his hands and blew into them. It's freezing down here. Melt it did, though, but somewhere in each of them, that snowman was still upright. It must have been the last thing they saw that Christmas Eve when they finally fell asleep. There was an accordion in their ears, a snowman in their eyes, and for Liesel, there was the thought of Max's last words before she left him by the fire. Christmas greetings from Max Vandenberg.
Often, I wish this would all be over, Liesel, but then somehow you do something, like walk down the basement steps with a snowman in your hands.
Unfortunately, that night signaled a severe downslide in Max's health. The early signs were innocent enough and typical. Constant coldness, swimming hands, increased visions of boxing with the Führer. It was only when he couldn't warm up after his push-ups and sit-ups that it truly began to worry him. As close to the fire as he sat, he could not raise himself to any degree of approximate health. Day by day, his weight began to stumble off him. His exercise regimen faltered and fell apart, with his cheek against the surly basement floor. All through January, he managed to hold himself together, but by early February, Max was in worrisome shape. He would struggle to wake up next to the fire, sleeping well into the morning instead, his mouth distorted and his cheekbones starting to swell. When asked, he said he was fine. In mid-February, a few days before Liesel was 13, he came to the fireplace on the verge of collapse. He nearly fell into the fire. Hans, he whispered, and his face seemed to cramp. His legs gave way, and his head hit the accordion case. At once, a wooden spoon fell into some soup, and Rosa Huberman was at his side. She held Max's head and barked across the room at Liesel.
Don't just stand there. Get the extra blankets. Take them to your bed. And you,
Papa was next,
help me pick him up and carry him to Liesel's room. Schnell!
Papa's face was stretched with concern. His gray eyes clanged, and he picked him up on his own. Max was light as a child.
Can't we put him here, in our bed?
Rosa had already considered that.
No, we have to keep these curtains open in the day, or else it looks suspicious.
Good point. Hans carried him out. Blankets in hand, Liesel watched. Limp feet and hanging hair in the hallway. One shoe had fallen off him.
Move!
Mama marched in behind them, in her waddlesome way. Once Max was in the bed, blankets were heaped on top and fastened around his body.
Mama?
Liesel couldn't bring herself to say anything else.
What?
The bun of Rosa Huberman's hair was wound tight enough to frighten from behind. It seemed to tighten further when she repeated the question.
What, Liesel?
She stepped closer, afraid of the answer.
Is he alive?
The bun nodded. Rosa turned then and said something with great assurance.
Now listen to me, Liesel. I didn't take this man into my house to watch him die. Understand?
Liesel nodded.
Now go.
In the hall, Papa hugged her. She desperately needed it. Later on, she heard Hans and Rosa speaking in the night. Rosa made her sleep in their room, and she lay next to their bed, on the floor, on the mattress they'd dragged up from the basement. There was concern as to whether it was infected, but they came to the conclusion that such thoughts were unfounded. This was no virus Max was suffering from, so they carried it up and replaced the sheet. Imagining the girl to be asleep, Mama voiced her opinion.
"That damn snowman," she whispered. "I bet it started with the snowman, fooling around with ice and snow in the cold down there."
Papa was more philosophical. "Rosa, it started with Adolf." He lifted himself. "We should check on him." In the course of the night, Max was visited 7 times. Max Vandenberg's visitor score sheet. Hans Huberman, 2. Rosa Huberman, 2. Liesel Memminger, 3. In the morning, Liesel brought him his sketchbook from the basement and placed it on the bedside table. She felt awful for having looked at it the previous year, and this time she kept it firmly closed, out of respect. When Papa came in, she did not turn to face him, but talked across Max Vandenberg, at the wall.
"Why did I have to bring all that snow down?" she asked. "It started all of this, didn't it, Papa?"
She clenched her hands as if to pray.
"Why did I have to build that snowman?"
Papa, to his enduring credit, was adamant.
"Liesl," he said, "you had to."
For hours, she sat with him as he shivered and slept.
"Don't die," she whispered. "Please, Max, just don't die."
He was the second snowman to be melting away before her eyes. Only this one was different. It was a paradox. The colder he became, the more he melted. 13 Presents. It was Max's arrival revisited. Feathers turned to twigs again. Smooth face turned to rough. The proof she needed was there. He was alive. The first few days, she sat and talked to him. On her birthday, she told him, there was an enormous cake waiting in the kitchen, if only he'd wake up. There was no waking. There was no cake. A late-night excerpt. I realized much later that I actually visited 33 Himmel Street in that period of time. It must have been one of the few moments when the girl was not there with him, for all I saw was a man in bed. I knelt. I readied myself to insert my hands through the blankets. Then there was a resurgence, an immense struggle against my weight. I withdrew, and with so much work ahead of me, it was nice to be fought off in that dark little room. I even managed a short, closed-eyed pause of serenity before I made my way out. On the 5th day, there was much excitement when Max opened his eyes, if only for a few moments. What he predominantly saw, and what a frightening version it must have been close up, was Rosa Huberman practically slinging an armful of soup into his mouth.
"Swallow," she advised him. "Don't think, just swallow."
As soon as Mama handed back the bowl, Liesel tried to see his face again, but there was a soup feeder's backside in the way.
"Is he still awake?"
When she turned, Rosa did not have to answer. After close to a week, Max woke up a second time, on this occasion with Liesel and Papa in the room. They were both watching the body in the bed when there was a small groan. If it's possible, Papa fell upward, out of the chair.
"Look!" Liesel gasped. "Stay awake, Max! Stay awake!"
He looked at her briefly, but there was no recognition. The eyes studied her as if she were a riddle. Then, gone again.
Papa, what happened?
Hans dropped back to the chair. Later, he suggested that perhaps she should read to him.
Come on, Liesl, you're such a good reader these days, even if it's a mystery to all of us where that book came from.
I told you, Papa, one of the nuns at school gave it to me.
Papa held his hands up in mock protest.
I know,
he sighed from a height. Just, he chose his words gradually. Don't get caught. This from a man who'd stolen a Jew. From that day on, Liesl read The Whistler aloud to Max as he occupied her bed. The one frustration was that she kept having to skip whole chapters on account of many of the pages being stuck together. It had not dried well. Still, she struggled on, to the point where she was nearly three-quarters of the way through it. The book was 396 pages. In the outside world, Liesl rushed from school each day, in the hope that Max was feeling better.
Has he woken up? Has he eaten?
Go back out, Mama begged her. You're chewing a hole in my stomach with all this talking. Go on, get out there and play soccer, for God's sake.
Yes, Mama.
She was about to open the door.
But you'll come and get me if he wakes up, won't you? Just make something up. Scream out like I've done something wrong. Start swearing at me. Everyone will believe it. Don't worry.
Even Rosa had to smile at that. She placed her knuckles on her hips and explained that Liesl wasn't too old yet to avoid a Watschen for talking in such a way.
And score a goal, she threatened, or don't come home at all.
Sure, Mama.
Make that 2 goals, Zaumensch.
Yes, Mama.
And stop answering back.
Liesl considered, but she ran onto the street to oppose Rudy on the mud-slippery road.
About time, ass scratcher.
He welcomed her in the customary way as they fought for the ball.
Where have you been?
Half an hour later, when the ball was squashed by the rare passage of a car on Himmel Street, Liesl had found her first present for Max Vandenberg. After judging it irreparable, all of the kids walked home in disgust, leaving the ball twitching on the cold, blistered road. Liesl and Rudy remained stooped over the carcass. There was a gaping hole on its side like a mouth.
You want it?
Liesl asked. Rudy shrugged.
What do I want with this squashed shit heap of a ball? There's no chance of getting air into it now, is there? Do you want it or not?
No, thanks. Rudy prodded it cautiously with his foot, as if it were a dead animal, or an animal that might be dead. As he walked home, Liesl picked the ball up and placed it under her arm. She could hear him call out,
Hey, Zaumensch!
She waited.
Zaumensch!
She relented.
What? I've got a bike without wheels here, too, if you want it. Stick your bike!
From her position on the street, the last thing she heard was the laughter of that Saukerl, Rudi Steiner. Inside, she made her way to the bedroom. She took the ball into Max and placed it at the end of the bed.
I'm sorry, she said. It's not much. But when you wake up, I'll tell you all about it. I'll tell you it was the grayest afternoon you can imagine, and this car, without its lights on, ran straight over the ball. Then the man got out and yelled at us. And then he asked for directions. The nerve of him!
Wake up, she wanted to scream. Or shake him. She didn't. All Liesl could do was watch the ball and its trampled, flaking skin. It was the first gift of many. Presents number 2 to number 5. 1 ribbon, 1 pinecone, 1 button, 1 stone. The soccer ball had given her an idea. Whenever she walked to and from school now, Liesl was on the lookout for discarded items that might be valuable to a dying man. She wondered at first why it mattered so much. How could something so seemingly insignificant give comfort to someone? A ribbon in a gutter, a pine cone on the street, a button leaning casually against a classroom wall, a flat, round stone from the river. If nothing else, it showed that she cared, and it might give them something to talk about when Max woke up. When she was alone, she would conduct those conversations. "So what's all this?" Max would say. "What's all this junk?"
Junk?
In her mind, she was sitting on the side of the bed. "This isn't junk, Max. These are what made you wake up." Presents number 6 to number 9. One feather, 2 newspapers, a candy wrapper, a cloud. The feather was lovely and trapped in the door hinges of the church on Munich Street. It poked itself crookedly out, and Liesel hurried over to rescue it. The fibers were combed flat on the left, but the right side was made of delicate edges and sections of jagged triangles. There was no other way of describing it. The newspapers came from the cold depths of a garbage can, enough said, and the candy wrapper was flat and faded. She found it near the school and held it up to the light. It contained a collage of shoe prints. Then the cloud. How do you give someone a piece of sky? Late in February, she stood on Munich Street and watched a single giant cloud come over the hills like a white monster. It climbed the mountains. The sun was eclipsed, and in its place, a white beast with a grey heart watched the town.
"Would you look at that?" she said to Papa.
Hans cocked his head and stated what he felt was the obvious. "You should give it to Max, Liesel. See if you can leave it on the bedside table, like all the other things." Liesel watched him as if he'd gone insane.
"How, though?"
Lightly, he tapped her skull with his knuckles. "Memorize it. Then write it down for him." "It was like a great white beast," she said at her next bedside vigil,
"and it came from over the mountains."
When the sentence was completed with several different adjustments and additions, Liesel felt like she'd done it. She imagined the vision of it passing from her hand to his through the blankets, and she wrote it down on a scrap of paper, placing the stone on top of it. Presents number 10 to number 13. One toy soldier, 1 miraculous leaf, a finished whistler, a slab of grief. The soldier was buried in the dirt, not far from Tommy Muller's place. It was scratched and trodden, which to Liesel was the whole point. Even with injury, it could still stand up. The leaf was a maple, and she found it in the school broom closet, among the buckets and feather dusters. The door was slightly ajar. The leaf was dry and hard, like toasted bread, and there were hills and valleys all over its skin. Somehow, the leaf had made its way into the school hallway and into that closet, like half a star with a stem. Liesel reached in and twirled it in her fingers. Unlike the other items, she did not place the leaf on the bedside table. She pinned it to the closed curtain just before reading the final 34 pages of The Whistler. She did not have dinner that afternoon or go to the toilet. She didn't drink. All day at school, she had promised herself that she would finish reading the book today, and Max Vandenberg was going to listen. He was going to wake up. Papa sat on the floor in the corner, workless as usual. Luckily, he would soon be leaving for the Knoller with his accordion. His chin resting on his knees, he listened to the girl he'd struggled to teach the alphabet. Reading proudly, she unloaded the final frightening words of the book to Max Vandenberg. The last remnants of the Whistler. The Viennese air was fogging up the windows of the train that morning, and as the people travelled obliviously to work, a murderer whistled his happy tune. He bought his ticket. There were polite greetings with fellow passengers and the conductor. He even gave up his seat for an elderly lady,
and made polite conversation with a gambler who spoke of American horses. After all, the Whistler loved talking. He talked to people and fooled them into liking him, trusting him. He talked to them while he was killing them, torturing and turning the knife. It was only when there was no one to talk to that he whistled, which was why he did so after a murder.
So you think the track will suit number 7, do you?
Of course. The gambler grinned. Trust was already there.
He'll come from behind and kill the whole lot of them.
He shouted it above the noise of the train. If you insist. The Whistler smirked, and he wondered at length when they would find the inspector's body in that brand new BMW.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph! Hans couldn't resist an incredulous tone.
A nun gave you that?
He stood up and made his way over, kissing her forehead. Bye, Liesel. The Knoller awaits.
Bye, Papa.
Liesel!
She ignored it.
Come and eat something.
She answered now.
I'm coming, Mama.
She actually spoke those words to Max as she came closer and placed the finished book on the bedside table with everything else. As she hovered above him, she couldn't help herself.
Come on, Max, she whispered.
And even the sound of Mama's arrival at her back did not stop her from silently crying. It didn't stop her from pulling a lump of salt water from her eye and feeding it onto Max Vandenberg's face. Mama took her. Her arms swallowed her.
I know, she said.
She knew. Fresh air, an old nightmare, and what to do with a Jewish corpse. They were by the Amper River, and Liesel had just told Rudy that she was interested in attaining another book from the mayor's house. In place of the Whistler, she'd read The Standover Man several times at Max's bedside. That was only a few minutes per reading. She'd also tried The Shoulder Shrug, even The Gravedigger's Handbook, but none of it seemed quite right. I want something new, she thought.
Did you even read the last one?
Of course I did.
Rudy threw a stone into the water.
Was it any good?
Of course it was.
Of course I did. Of course it was.
He tried to dig another rock out of the ground, but cut his finger.
That'll teach you. Zaumensch.
When a person's last response was Zaumensch or Zaukerl or Arschloch, you knew you had them beaten. In terms of stealing, conditions were perfect. It was a gloomy afternoon early in March and only a few degrees above freezing, always more uncomfortable than 10 degrees below. Very few people were out on the streets. Rain like grey pencil shavings.
Are we going?
Bikes, said Rudy. You can use one of ours.
On this occasion, Rudy was considerably more enthusiastic about being the enterer.
Today it's my turn, he said as their fingers froze to the bike handles.
Liesel thought fast.
Maybe you shouldn't, Rudy. There's stuff all over the place in there, and it's dark. An idiot like you is bound to trip over or run into something.
Thanks very much.
In this mood, Rudy was hard to contain.
There's the drop, too. It's deeper than you think.
Are you saying you don't think I can do it?
Liesel stood up on the pedals.
Not at all.
They crossed the bridge and serpentined up the hill to Grandestrasse. The window was open. Like last time, they surveyed the house. Vaguely they could see inside, to where a light was on downstairs, in what was probably the kitchen. A shadow moved back and forth.
We'll just ride around the block a few times, Rudy said. Lucky we brought the bikes, huh?
Just make sure you remember to take yours home.
Very funny, Zaumensch. It's a bit bigger than your filthy shoes.
They rode
for perhaps 15 minutes, and still the mayor's wife was downstairs, a little too close for comfort. How dare she occupy the kitchen with such vigilance? For Rudy, the kitchen was undoubtedly the actual goal. He'd have gone in, robbed as much food as was physically possible, then if, and only if, he had a last moment to spare, he would stuff a book down his pants on the way out. Any book would do. Rudy's weakness, however, was impatience.
"It's getting late," he said and began to ride off. "You coming?"
Liesl didn't come. There was no decision to be made. She'd lugged that rusty bike all the way up there, and she wasn't leaving without a book. She placed the handlebars in the gutter, looked out for any neighbors, and walked to the window. There was good speed, but no hurry. She took her shoes off, using her feet, treading on the heels with her toes. Her fingers tightened on the wood, and she made her way inside. This time, if only slightly, she felt more at ease. In a few precious moments, she circled the room, looking for a title that grabbed her. On 3 or 4 occasions, she nearly reached out. She even considered taking more than one, but again, she didn't want to abuse what was a kind of system. For now, only one book was necessary. She studied the shelves and waited. An extra darkness climbed through the window behind her. The smell of dust and theft loitered in the background, and she saw it. The book was red, with black writing on the spine. Der Traumträger, the Dream Carrier. She thought of Max Vandenberg and his dreams. Of guilt, surviving, leaving his family, fighting the Führer. She also thought of her own dream. Her brother, dead on the train, and his appearance on the steps just around the corner from this very room. The book thief watched his bloodied knee from the shove of her own hand. She slid the book from the shelf, tucked it under her arm, climbed to the window ledge, and jumped out, all in one motion. Rudy had her shoes. He had her bike ready. Once the shoes were on, they rode.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph Memminger!"
He'd never called her Memminger before.
"You're an absolute lunatic, do you know that?"
Liesl agreed as she pedaled like hell.
"I know it."
At the bridge, Rudy summed up the afternoon's proceedings.
"Those people are either completely crazy," he said, "or they just like their fresh air."
A small suggestion. Or maybe there was a woman on Grandestrasse who now kept her library window open for another reason. But that's just me being cynical. Or hopeful. Or both. Liesl placed the dream carrier beneath her jacket and began reading it the minute she returned home. In the wooden chair next to her bed, she opened the book and whispered,
"It's a new one, Max. Just for you."
She started reading.
Chapter 1. It was quite fitting that the entire town was sleeping when the dream carrier was born.
Every day, Liesl read 2 chapters of the book. One in the morning before school, and one as soon as she came home. On certain nights when she was not able to sleep, she read half of a 3rd chapter as well. Sometimes she would fall asleep slumped forward onto the side of the bed. It became her mission. She gave the dream carrier to Max, as if the words alone could nourish him. On a Tuesday, she thought there was movement. She could have sworn his eyes had opened. If they had, it was only momentarily, and it was more likely just her imagination and wishful thinking. By mid-March, the cracks began to appear. Rosa Huberman, the good woman for a crisis, was at breaking point one afternoon in the kitchen. She raised her voice, then brought it quickly down. Liesl stopped reading and made her way quietly to the hall. As close as she stood, she could still barely make out her mama's words. When she was able to hear them, she wished she hadn't, for what she heard was horrific. It was reality. The contents of Mama's voice. "What if he doesn't wake up? What if he dies here, Hansi?
Tell me, what in God's name will we do with the body? We can't leave him here. The smell will kill us. And we can't carry him out the door and drag him up the street either.
We can't just say, you'll never guess what we found in our basement this morning. They'll put us away for good.
She was absolutely right. A Jewish corpse was a major problem. The Hubermans needed to revive Max Vandenberg, not only for his sake, but for their own. Even Papa, who was always the ultimate calming influence, was feeling the pressure. Look. His voice was quiet but heavy. If it happens, if he dies, we'll simply need to find a way. Liesel could have sworn she heard him swallow. A gulp like a blow to the windpipe. My paint cart, some drop sheets. Liesel entered the kitchen. Not now, Liesel. It was Papa who spoke, though he did not look at her. He was watching his warped face in a turned-over spoon. His elbows were buried into the table. The book thief did not retreat. She took a few extra steps and sat down. Her cold hands felt for her sleeves, and a sentence dropped from her mouth.
He's not dead yet.
The words landed on the table and positioned themselves in the middle. All three people looked at them. Half hopes didn't dare rise any higher. He isn't dead yet. He isn't dead yet. It was Rosa who spoke next.
Who's hungry?
Possibly the only time that Max's illness didn't hurt was at dinner. There was no denying it, as the three of them sat at the kitchen table with their extra bread and extra soup or potatoes. They all thought it, but no one spoke. In the night, just a few hours later, Liesel awoke and wondered at the height of her heart. She had learned that expression from the Dream Carrier, which was essentially the complete antithesis of The Whistler, a book about an abandoned child who wanted to be a priest. She sat up and sucked deeply at the nighttime air.
Liesel? Papa rolled over. What is it?
Nothing, Papa. Everything's good.
But the very moment she'd finished the sentence, she saw exactly what had happened in her dream. One small image. For the most part, all is identical. The train moves at the same speed. Copiously, her brother coughs. This time, however, Liesel cannot see his face watching the floor. Slowly, she leans over. Her hand lifts him gently from his chin, and there in front of her is the wide-eyed face of Max Vandenberg. He stares at her. A feather drops to the floor. The body is bigger now, matching the size of the face. The train screams.
Liesel? I said, everything's good.
Shivering, she climbed from the mattress. Stupid with fear, she walked through the hallway to Max. After many minutes at his side when everything slowed, she attempted to interpret the dream. Was it a premonition of Max's death? Or was it merely a reaction to the afternoon conversation in the kitchen? Had Max now replaced her brother? And if so, how could she discard her own flesh and blood in such a way? Perhaps it was even a deep-seated wish for Max to die. After all, if it was good enough for Werner, her brother, it was good enough for this Jew.
Is that what you think?
She whispered, standing above the bed.
No.
She could not believe it. Her answer was sustained as the numbness of the dark waned and outlined the various shapes, big and small, on the bedside table. The presence.
Wake up, she said.
Max did not wake up for 8 more days. At school, there was a rapping of knuckles on the door.
Come in,
called Frau Ollendrich. The door opened, and the entire classroom of children looked on in surprise as Rosa Huberman stood in the doorway. One or two gasped at the sight, a small wardrobe of a woman with a lipstick sneer and chlorine eyes. This was the legend. She was wearing her best clothes, but her hair was a mess, and it was a towel of elastic grey strands. The teacher was obviously afraid.
Frau Huberman!
Her movements were cluttered. She searched through the class.
Liesel?
Liesel looked at Rudy, stood, and walked quickly toward the door to end the embarrassment as fast as possible. It shut behind her, and now she was alone in the corridor with Rosa. Rosa faced the other way.
"What, Mama?"
She turned.
"Don't you what Mama me, you little Zaumensch?"
Liesel was gored by the speed of it.
"My hairbrush!"
A trickle of laughter rolled from under the door, but it was drawn instantly back.
"Mama?"
Her face was severe, but it was smiling.
"What the hell did you do with my hairbrush, you stupid Zaumensch, you little thief? I've told you 100 times to leave that thing alone, but do you listen? Of course not!"
The tirade went on for perhaps another minute, with Liesel making a desperate suggestion or two about the possible location of the said brush. It ended abruptly, with Rosa pulling Liesel close just for a few seconds. Her whisper was almost impossible to hear, even at such close proximity.
"You told me to yell at you. You said they'd all believe it."
She looked left and right, her voice like needle and thread.
"He woke up, Liesel. He's awake."
From her pocket, she pulled out the toy soldier with a scratched exterior.
"He said to give you this. It was his favorite."
She handed it over, held her arms tightly, and smiled. Before Liesel had a chance to answer, she finished it off.
"Well, answer me. Do you have any other idea where you might have left it?"
"He's alive,"
Liesel thought.
"No, Mama. I'm sorry, Mama.
Well, what good are you, then?"
She let go, nodded, and walked away. For a few moments, Liesel stood. The corridor was huge. She examined the soldier in her palm. Instinct told her to run home immediately, but common sense did not allow it. Instead, she placed the ragged soldier in her pocket and returned to the classroom. Everyone waited.
"Stupid cow,"
she whispered under her breath. Again, kids laughed. Frau Ollendrich did not.
"What was that?"
Liesel was on such a high that she felt indestructible.
"I said," she beamed, "stupid cow."
And she didn't have to wait a single moment for the teacher's hand to slap her.
"Don't speak about your mother like that,"
she said. But it had little effect. The girl merely stood there and attempted to hold off the grin. After all, she could take a watschen with the best of them.
"Now get to your seat."
"Yes, Frau Ollendrich."
Next to her, Rudi dared to speak.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," he whispered. "I can see her hand on your face, a big red hand, 5 fingers.
"Good," said Liesel, "because Max was alive." When she made it home that afternoon, he was sitting up in bed with the deflated soccer ball on his lap. His beard itched him, and his swampy eyes fought to stay open. An empty bowl of soup was next to the gifts. They did not say hello. It was more like edges. The door creaked, the girl came in, and she stood before him looking at the bowl.
"Is Mama forcing it down your throat?"
He nodded, content, fatigued. It was very good, though.
"Mama's soup? Really?"
It was not a smile he gave her. "Thank you for the presents." More just a slight tear of the mouth. "Thank you for the cloud. Your papa explained that one a little further." After an hour, Liesel also made an attempt on the truth.
"We didn't know what we'd do if you'd died, Max.
It didn't take him long. "You mean how to get rid of me?"
"I'm sorry."
"No." He was not offended. "You were right." He played weakly with the ball. "You were right to think that way. In your situation, a dead Jew is just as dangerous as a live one, if not worse."
"I also dreamed."
In detail, she explained it, with a soldier in her grip. She was on the verge of apologizing again when Max intervened.
"Liesel,"
he made her look at him, "don't ever apologize to me. It should be me who apologizes to you." He looked at everything she'd brought him. Look at all this, these gifts. He held the button in his hand. And Rosa said, you read to me twice every day, sometimes three times. Now he looked at the curtains, as if he could see out of them. He sat up a little higher and paused for a dozen silent sentences. Trepidation found its way onto his face, and he made a confession to the girl. Liesel. He moved slightly to the right. I'm afraid, he said, of falling asleep again. Liesel was resolute.
Then I'll read to you, and I'll slap your face if you start dozing off. I'll close the book and shake you till you wake up.
That afternoon, and well into the night, Liesel read to Max Vandenberg. He sat in bed and absorbed the words, awake this time, until just after 10 o'clock. When Liesel took a quick rest from the dream carrier, she looked over the book, and Max was asleep. Nervously, she nudged him with it. He awoke. Another 3 times, he fell asleep. Twice more, she woke him. For the next 4 days, he woke up every morning in Liesel's bed, then next to the fireplace, and eventually, by mid-April, in the basement. His health had improved, the beard was gone, and small scraps of weight had returned. In Liesel's inside world, there was great relief in that time. Outside, things were starting to look shaky. Late in March, a place called Lübeck was hailed with bombs. Next in line would be Cologne, and soon enough, many more German cities, including Munich. Yes, the boss was at my shoulder. Get it done! Get it done! The bombs were coming, and so was I. Death's Diary, Cologne. The fallen hours of May the 30th. I'm sure Liesel Memminger was fast asleep when more than 1,000 bomber planes flew toward a place known as Köln. For me, the result was 500 people or thereabouts. 50,000 others ambled homelessly around the ghostly piles of rubble, trying to work out which way was which, and which slabs of broken home belonged to whom. 500 souls. I carried them in my fingers, like suitcases, or I'd throw them over my shoulder. It was only the children I carried in my arms. By the time I was finished, the sky was yellow, like burning newspaper. If I looked closely, I could see the words, reporting headlines, commentating on the progress of the war, and so forth. How I'd have loved to pull it all down, to screw up the newspaper sky and toss it away. My arms ached, and I couldn't afford to burn my fingers. There was still so much work to be done. As you might expect, many people died instantly. Others took a while longer. There were several more places to go, skies to meet, and souls to collect. And when I came back to Cologne later on, not long after the final planes, I managed to notice a most unique thing. I was carrying the charred soul of a teenager, when I looked gravely up at what was now a sulfuric sky. A group of 10-year-old girls was close by. One of them called out,
"What's that?"
Her arm extended, and her finger pointed out the black, slow object falling from above. It began as a black feather, lilting, floating, or a piece of ash. Then it grew larger. The same girl, a redhead with period freckles, spoke once again, this time more emphatically.
"What is that?" "It's a body," another girl suggested,
black hair, pigtails, and a crooked part down the center.
"It's another bomb!"
It was too slow to be a bomb. With the adolescent spirit still burning lightly in my arms, I walked a few hundred meters with the rest of them. Like the girls, I remained focused on the sky. The last thing I wanted was to look down at the stranded face of my teenager. A pretty girl. Her whole death was now ahead of her. Like the rest of them, I was taken aback when a voice lunged out. It was a disgruntled father ordering his kids inside. The redhead reacted. Her freckles lengthened into commas.
But, Papa, look!
The man took several small steps, and soon figured out what it was.